Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 8th of September 2018, Episode 2. As I go through rehab, just trying to push myself over the hour limit of reading, but keeping up the quality. So, look, unfortunately, the quality will drop, and that's part of the objective from my end, so obviously not from your end. So this is in the in-brief section, but to get on before the main sections afterwards. So this unfortunately doesn't have an author with it. AI could help doctors stay one step ahead of cancer. An artificial intelligence, it's got to be artificial intelligence or CRISPR, system called Revolver is unveiling evolutionary tricks cancers use to spread to defy treatment. It should allow doctors to more accurately identify what stage cancers have reached, what they will do next and how to stop them. Now, what I have to say is interesting that a cell can be in a new position and the new cancer cell can take up a position in a new section, but it has the signature of the, what are they called, spindles inside it, microtubules distribution, which can be read and analysed to see its source organ. So that's an interesting piece of innovation. If we can treat cancer, we can intervene early enough, says Andrea Stotovia, the Institute of Cancer Research in London, whose team is developing Revolver. Quote, the key is you can stay one head, can you stay one head step of the disease? He says, Revolver helps Stratova's team unmask key evolutionary steps in cancer. He uses data from the patient to create a genetic, quote, family tree, tracking how cancer evolved, and identifies a series of mutations that most often lead to cancer. Existing analysis, often relying on samples from one patient, can struggle to distinguish important mutations from harmless ones. Revolver, instead, analyzes mutation data from 178 patients, covering 768 tumor samples of four types of cancer, bowel, lung, breast, kidney. This made key evolutionary steps stand out better. More data would help you, wouldn't it? I don't understand. Three key gene mutations are known to be crucial for benign colon polyps to turn cancerous. For example, but do not have been seen together in a single patient. Despite this, Revolver identified the three mutations as key ones when tested with gene profiles from 95 colorectal cancer patients. Okay, well, I'm just looking at it, there's 95, you can see what the other patients would be. So that's just not a very large sample because you've got four different things. It correctly identified key mutations already known to drive evolution of lung, breast and kidney cancer. Okay, it's hard to actually extract from that the real value. MS drug halves losses of brain tissue. An experimental drug for the most severe forms of multiple sclerosis is solid shrinkage by nearly 50%. The loss of brain tissue, well, I don't know, obviously if you're losing 10% and lose 5% instead, it's so hard to know what the percentage is. 50% seems large, but it could be not if that's big. The loss of brain tissue is a marker of disease progression in primary secondary progressive multiple sclerosis. In these forms of the disease, the ongoing breakdown of protective myelin that surrounds the nervous fiber in the brain leads to slower nerve signals, which ultimately result in muscle weakness and problems with balance and vision. Robert Fox of Cleveland Clinic in Ohio led a phase 2 clinical trial of a drug called Ibadilast, which inhibits proteins that can result in central nervous system inflammation. The trial involved 255 people from the US, with 126 receiving a placebo instead of the real drug. Okay, like that's a real trial. Each took up to 10 capsules per day for 22 months and had brain scans every 6 months to gain the volume of brain tissue. The team found that, on average, Ibadilast slowed brain shrinkage by 48% compared with the placebo, with those being given long given the drug, losing 2.5 millimetres less brain matter. So that would be... Well, that's actually quite significant now, because millimetres would be actual physical radius. So that's a cube. Now, that's pretty amazing. Print with sound using honey as ink. Sound using honey as ink. Printers that use sound waves may one day build structures out of honey droplets, or even print human tissues without harming cells. Regular ink printers are great at controlling the placement of the size of ink droplets, but only work in watery fluids. The inkjets are just amazing, and I just know the kids nowadays have no knowledge of them. No one has ever seen them. Inkjet printers rely on a stream of liquid naturally separating into drops. To make the droplets from a viscous fluid, that fluid has to be forcibly broken. The team turn to sound waves, which can exert forces on objects. The printer excludes a droplet from a nozzle and then fires a sound wave at it to make it fall in the printing surface. The sound is extremely loud, but it is at a high frequency that the human ear cannot detect. Researchers tested the printer using water, honey, and a fluid mix of gallium and indium metal. They also tried an ink full of human cells to confirm they wouldn't be killed by the sound. With the cells, you could do tissue engineering. Yeah. Well, there's so many 3D printing technologies coming along. I love the one which just rises like a phoenix. Okay, insights into hydrogen cars. Alice Klein writes, gassed up and ready to go, vehicles that run on hydrogen have been dismissed by the likes of Elon Musk and myself, actually. But let's see what this person has to say. This is by Alice Klein. Hydrogen-powered cars have had a bumpy ride back. I remember Bocchus in what was he? 78. Professor Bocchus. Hydrogen economy. Back in 2003, they were touted as one of the most encouraging innovative technologies of our era by President of the time, George W. Bush. Then the Tesla revolution came along and they were left in the dust by their battery-driven electric rivals. Now there are signs of a comeback. A recent recovery of more than survey of 800 global automotive executives by consulting firm KPMG found that 50% rated hydrogen fuel cells vehicles as a leading industry trend. That's leaving me not very impressed. This may be that most executives are just dumb. Japan has announced a plan to put 40,000 hydrogen vehicles on the road in the next 5 years. And South Korea, 16,000. Germany wants to have 400 refueling stations by 2025. California has already opened 35. The renewed push has its skeptics. Tesla's chief, Elon Musk, for example, has dismissed hydrogen cars as being extremely silly, which I would say so. Joan Ogden at the University of California, Davis sees the future in which hydrogen and electric vehicles play complementary roles. There are arguments having both, she says. Like electric cars, hydrogen vehicles produce zero pollutants and carbon emissions. Except you've got to actually produce the hydrogen and the electricity with zero pollution as well. So you can't get a coal power station, as we would do in Australia. You have to have it's just impossible. So they don't damage the health or the climate. Demand issues. Hydrogen cars use fuel cells instead of a battery to power an electric motor. Hydrogen stored in the tank and fed to the fuel cell, where its chemical energy is converted into electrical energy. See diagram above right. Hydrogen cars are finally becoming commercially viable because the fuel cells have become smaller and lighter, says Matthew McCloyd of Toyota, which began selling the Mira, one of the first mass-market hydrogen cars, in 2014 for $60,000. Honda and Hyundai have competing models, and Mercedes-Benz plans to launch one next year. We're also figuring out better ways to transport and store hydrogen, says Michael Doolan of Australia's National Science Organisation, CSIRO. Last month, his team showed that hydrogen gas can be converted to liquid ammonium for transportation, then converted back using a membrane made from metal vanadium. Good on you, vanadium. Well, yeah, I mean, there's just so much you can use it. It just does that metal poison. How long does it last? Liquid ammonia takes up less space, but it can be bloody explosive and dangerous, is my experience. It's less vulnerable than hydrogen, making it easier to ship to refueling stations. Yeah, but it's also... Oh, bloody... Oh, so you use the ammonia to carry the hydrogen. Now, there's a lot of energy making the ammonia in the first place, the Haber cycle. The ability to rapidly refuel is one of the main advantages of hydrogen vehicles over the electric counterparts, says McLeod. Filling up a hydrogen car takes about the same time as filling a liquid petrol one, rather than hours typically takes to recharge. So all they have to do is find a rapidly recharged battery, like bank of supercapacitors. An electric car's battery. You can go further on a full tank of hydrogen, about 500 kilometres, compared with 300 kilometres on a standard full-charged battery. But although hydrogen reacts cleanly, the only becoming out the exhaust pipe as water, hydrogen vehicles are more energy-intensive than electric ones if you factor the fuel production and transport, says Jake Whitehead at the University of Queensland, Australia. At the moment, most hydrogen is extracted from natural gas or fossil fuel. Green hydrogen can be made by splitting water using solar and wind power, but involves multiple steps, each using energy along the way. In contrast, a single step is required directly to charge the battery at home. There is a lot to think. Oh, look, if you're using methane to make hydrogen, why not just give them the methane, my friend? It's beyond me. If you're using petrol to make hydrogen. Okay, clean fuel. If you count for the complete energy cycle, Whitehead's modelling showed that a hydrogen vehicle requires 80 to 100 kilowatt hours of electricity to travel 100 kilometres, compared with 20 kilowatt hours to travel the same distance in a battery vehicle. This is the main charge level by Musk. Hydrogen cars. The efficiency is terrible, so why would you do that? It makes no sense, he told reporters of the Automotive News World Congress in Detroit 2015. Hydrogen fuel is also more expensive than petrol. Hydrogen cars currently cost 13 cents per kilometre to run, compared with 8 cents per kilometre for petrol cars. However, some predictions suggest that the cost will become equivalent in 2015 as the technology to produce hydrogen becomes cheaper. At the moment, there are only about 6,000 hydrogen vehicles on the road globally, compared with 2 million electric vehicles. But Olgan says that hydrogen vehicles may end up becoming more popular among certain drivers. Quote, if you're only using your car for short commutes or to get around the city, battery cars handle all your needs, she says. But if you want a big car that you can take on long drives in the mountains on a whim, to obviously woo your person, I want a long country drive, a hydrogen fuel cell might be better. The shorter refueling time, the longer the range of the hydrogen fuel cell, also makes them appealing for taxis, buses, and long-haul trucks, and so on. These vehicles can't afford just stopping for hours at a time to recharge. If they cost twice as much, you can have two taxis. Only the cost has to come down significantly. Especially driverless cars, I think that's, we're at the end of the road for them. So driverless cars can drive and recharge, do all the recharging for you. Hydrogen fuel cells are already finding applications in these heavy use vehicles. Japan will showcase 100 hydrogen buses in the Tokyo Olympics, 2020 Olympics, which I really think is that's where they have to go, hydrogen buses. A fleet of 180 hydrogen taxi, private hire and police cars are being trialled in London. Paris and Brussels and retailer Amazon have recently invested hydrogen-powered forklifts for its warehouses. Actually, will imagine, especially in a warehouse, the fuel is noxious. US manufacturer Nikola Motors, meanwhile, says it has received 11,000 pre-orders for its hydrogen fuel cell truck. Japan and South Korea are leading the push because they want to embrace zero-emission technologies, but their combination of small landmass and large populations mean they don't have enough solar, wind, or other renewable energy to support large number of battery electrical vehicles, says Dolan. This is mentally hurting my head to read this. They can't import renewable energy itself. Why not? If you make the hydrogen renewable, why not? I just don't understand. But they can import these underground cables? Why don't we have a renewable up in... Oh, I don't understand. They can't import renewable itself, but they want to import hydrogen made from renewable energy from other countries. Australia, for example, could use abundant solar energy to split water and export hydrogen to these countries, says Dillon. But I would also say we could just put in high voltage DC. You can see hydrogen basically as a carrier of renewable energy. Many people feel jittery about hydrogen because of its connection with hydrogen bombs. That is dumb as dumb you could possibly do. And the 37 Hindenburg disaster, which a hydrogen-filled airship spectacularly caught fire, killing 36 people. But the hydrogen tanks used in modern fuel cell vehicles are made from multiple layers of resin, carbon fiber, and fiberglass that keep the flammable gas safely contained. Tests show that they can even survive being shot or being set on fire. In fact, hydrogen is actually rather a hard thing to condense. Now, Fukushima was a hydrogen explosion. Like in the forms of ammonia, will also make deployment safer, says McLeod. But I think we earlier said we're going to use hydrogen, ammonia to transport. This is all confused. The most probable future scenario is that we'll have a mix of vehicles, of batteries, hydrogen and petrol, each performing different roles, says Organ. Petrol is a polluting role. There are proponents of different technologies saying it's all going to be all hydrogen and all batteries, but automakers are putting the money on both. She says, according to KPMG survey, the brilliant survey you did of executives, car makers are predicting an even four-way split between electric, hydrogen, petrol and hybrid by 2040. There you go. The final mix will depend on the willingness of governments and industry to invest in hydrogen infrastructure. Blood oath, I don't think you have any luck here in Australia, as well as consumer enthusiasm for hydrogen cars. But whether it ends up being hydrogen or battery power, what wins the biggest share at any dent of dominance in petrol vehicles is likely to be a good thing. Less emitted carbon to a globe, less toxic exhaust fumes choking our lungs, less smog staining our skylines, we'll be all better off. So we really need... I don't know, that's it. This is a comment. Okay. Sheer lunacy. I like this. You'll be warned that there is no comment to start off with. You lay it in and there's a comment. The US plan to build a habitable station orbiting the moon is the worst idea of the new space age, says Robert Zubin. It's got to be Trump. It's got to be dumb. That is really bonker dumb. How dumb could you get? Okay, before the recent Mars Society convention, I was asked what I thought of the US plan to send astronauts to the moon. No doubt I was expected to explain why the red planet is a more suitable goal, but I said this is a much more than the moon versus Mars. I'm prepared to make the case for prioritizing Mars, though. Once warm and wet, it may have evolved life. And if we can find evidence of it, we would learn a lot about the possible prevalence, diversity, life, and cosmos. In terms of the questions spent, there's a lot of other questions which are worthwhile answering soon. I'm prepared to wait because it's going to be outside my lifetime when the question's answered. I prefer other things done. Taking on Mars would inspire millions of young people into science. That's the dumbest argument I've ever heard. It's also the closest planet with resources for human settlement. In short, Mars is where the science is, where the challenge is, and where the future is. It should be the goal. Well, there you go. He's got it all mapped out for you. Unfortunately, that argument assumes that those making US space policy think it's important for NASA's human spaceflight program to have any goal at all. This is far from evidence. While the Trump administration says that it is setting its sights on return to the moon, its actions do not lend credence to such claim. If it intended to put people on the moon again, it would fund the development of the lunar lander. Instead, it's funding the Lunar Orbit Platform Gateway, a costly boondoggle that serves no useful purpose. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence talks of it as a done deal. My God. Oh, God, that's just depressing. What he fails to add is that we don't need a lunar orbiting base to go to the moon, or to Mars, or to go anywhere. Not only that, crewed ships to anywhere beyond Earth orbit would be designed to use the gateway as a staging post, adding fuel requirements and decreasing the load that they can carry, which is why I call lunar orbit a toll booth instead. It hurts me to read it. I'd have to see the things. Okay. That's it. However, this continues. Yet the problem with the bigger project is bigger than the waste of time and money and the harmful distortion imposed on the missions. The deeper problem is the form of thinking it represents. NASA's astronomy and robotic exploration programs have achieved epic accomplishments because they are purpose-driven. In contrast, since Apollo ended, NASA's human flight work has been purpose-free. As a result, accomplishments have been few. The science program has spent money to do things. The human space flight program is doing things to spend money. That's a pretty vicious person. He's really good. The situation is ironic. With the success of the Falcon Heavy rocket that would send crew to the moon and Mars, the US is poised for a deep space breakthrough. It just really hurts me reading all this. And the lunar orbit toll booth crash, if spent on developing landers and ascent vehicles, could enable return to the lunar surface within 4 years and a mission to Mars in 8. I think this person is over the top. What is lacking is intelligent direction. You betcha. We'll never get to Mars if we allow our human spaceflight program to be run by as a random walk. Oh, that's beautiful. I love that random walk. Okay, Robert Zubrin is an astronautical engineer. He's the president of the Mars Society, which advocates a mission to the planet. Well, he's a bit over the top, isn't he? Okay. If they value facts, Americans will elect a scientist, says Jonathan Norton. Okay, I like that one. Battle for political power in the US is heating up. The two main parties are stepping up pleas to support this autumn's midterm election, which will decide who controls Congress. That's nothing unusual. But November's vote does offer something of electorate hasn't seen before. A dedicated push to get candidates with science backgrounds on the ballot. Anti-science attitude in the US, and you can imagine that would be such a refreshing thing. We've got some real anti-science people here in Australia. Are well documented. For those who, enraged by them, help is at the hand. I started the 114 action in 2016 to recruit, train, support scientists running for office. And we've been laying the groundwork to bring evidence-based policy to the halls of power ever since. Oh, I'm really uncomfortable with that. Okay. I found this organized. I just think doing it directly is not the major thing, is to inform all parties. I don't know, it's slightly different. I would put my efforts slightly to the off of directly helping scientists. I founded the organization in part because I know how hard it is for a candidate with a STEM background if I was one myself. I'm a chemist by training and I ran for Congress in 2014. I realized that if you aren't a lawyer or a career politician, it can be hard to break into politics. Take, for example, the simple barrier of entry for scientists in the middle of their careers. Unlike lawyers, who are often encouraged by their forums to run, taking a year off to campaign can spell the end of a scientist's career. Our organisation acts as a support system, a siren call for a community that has long shied away from politics. That's how you spell shied, S-H-I-E-D. I didn't know that. The response has been promising. An unprecedented number of scientists ditched lab coats for suits and launched campaigns. While I neither expect nor desire every seat in Congress to be held by persons with STEM backgrounds, 2018 will be a great chance to bolster the scientific community's representation there. Currently there is one physicist, Representative Bill Foster, of course, it was going to be Bill Nye. There are more than 200 lawyers. There are more talk radio hosts in Congress than physicists and chemists. The time for signing polite letters and waiting to be tapped for an advisory role is over. Scientists need to get involved. It sounds like the suffragette movement. Voters want governance based on facts and evidence. I don't think they will. Voters just want a bigger hamburger, I think. And who better to lead and charge them than those who have spent their careers in a role where there is no room for alternative facts. I'm really nervous about listening to that. That's over the top. Are modern teens hurting or happy? 25 minutes in. Alarming headlines suggest that 1 in 4 teenage girls in the UK are self-harming, motivated by sexist stereotypes and pressures to look at the good self in society. The truth may not be as bleak as it first appears. I bet this is a survey where they have actually not set it up properly. They've set up general things. They've said, oh yes, we can do that, and they produce a great statistic. It's like Australia. Number of jobs at the airport is 10,000, right? That's at maximum, where each job is a job year. So they just drop the job year, so it's 10 years, is 1,000. And then that's really comes to 500 jobs. That gets inflated by multiplying factor of 10 for 10 years. It's just amazing stuff. Let's see what's here. The story's come to report from a report of UK charity, the Children's Society, based on a survey of 11,000 children aged 14 called the Millennium Cohort Study. Among girls, 22% they had self-harmed, and for boys, it's 9%. But while the term self-harm conjures up images of teenagers cutting themselves, that may, thankfully, be only the most extreme end of the broader spectrum. In the survey, participants were merely asked if they had hurt themselves on purpose in any way. Some could have answered yes for things like punching the wall in frustration or deliberately getting falling down drunk. Others could have thought the question included mental hurt, such as spending a miserable evening stalking an ex on social media. That he need to have done something like that just once in the past year for it to count. Again, that's, can I say? Well, okay. Such self-destructive behaviour would naturally be of concern to parents who wouldn't be that unusual for teenagers. Max Davey, a health promotion officer at the UK Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health, does believe that self-harming among teens is somewhat on the rise, but thinks the question in a survey was not specific enough to reveal its prevalence. It's one of these things where you get a major problem in the article, but you still have to write one. The latest headlines join the ongoing narrative. This is by Claire Wilson again. The latest headlines join the ongoing narrative about mental health crisis in today's youth. That really doesn't say anything, because there is a narrative and it's just going to join it. Some blame cutbacks in social services, while others point to loosening sexual norms by putting teens at risk. For those wary of new technologies, of social media, or the latest popular computer games. But such reports also deserve some skepticism. Claims of soaring rates of depression are usually based on surveys with very loose, non-medical criteria. Teenagers have always been sad and anxious from time to time. Thankfully, clinical depression is still rare in this age group. In fact, a different and regularly repeated survey was found no change in 11 to 15 year olds' happiness and life as a whole between 1995 and 2016. Now, there is a survey that we do in Australia called Tell Them From Me. It's a Canadian based survey, and I, as a scientist, looked up, and this person had huge 20 publications of pretty much the same paper in his own conferences, and he set up but the people had no ability to judge the quality of this, and this Tell Them From Me survey is appalling. And we can't obviously talk about it because it gives them data for people to do busy work with. Okay, this survey called Understanding Society even found a boost in happiness with family and schoolwork was over that period. There's more of risk findings were also in the latest Children's Society report. but were buried at the bottom of their press release. Davey thinks the rise in self-harm may not be due to a rise in happiness, but simply that this age group now sees self-harm as a more culturally acceptable way to express anguish. Quote, "It may be that the previous people didn't know that it was something you could do. If people are talking about themselves and normalizing it, it's probably more likely that their peers will do it." So really their self-harm thing could actually engender, you know, releasing this statistic could engender it. This is the risk. If this is the case, it's all the more reason not to make self-harm seem more common than it really is. Yeah, I just think they're actually probably causing self-harm. Okay, there's a picture of a very sort of woolly insect looking at you. And it's called eye to eye. You can see its eyes, lots of compound eyes. And it's just, I was just looking at the detail of it. I just really love the occasional, I suppose, faults or dislocations in the compound eyes. And you look at it carefully enough, you can see it's fairly good, but every once in a while, two lines collapse to one. This is a crystal defect in a sphere. "No need to fear this hairy monster." This is the picture. "This poplar hawk moth couldn't even bite you. It has no functioning mouth parts and will never be able to eat." It must be a sexual thing. Okay. The moths, Laerothea populi, are found all over Europe and can reach the size of a small bat. Unlike other moths, they have no proboscis protruding from their head. They're unable to sip nectar from flowers. Said they don't rely solely on body fat they stored as energy when they were caterpillars. This keeps them going for just 3 or 4 weeks, meaning the race is on to find a partner and mate. The large insect uses pheromones to find each other. The moth is a male and will use his yellow antenna to search for scent. We can see yellow antenna here. Emitting from females at night. The females send their signals and wait. They are so weighed down with eggs that flying is too strenuous. If they mate successfully, the eggs are laid and more than 100 pale green caterpillars will emerge a week later. Before winter arrives, these bulk up on the food that gives the species a common name, the leaves of poplar tree. And the poplar tree has the scent of smokeless ash. That's why they're used in matches. Quote, "I wouldn't have stood a chance had this individual been flying," says the photographer. "Alex, I bet he's dead as well," says Alex. Close up. "He snapped this hawk moth as it rested in Derbyshire, UK, early one summer morning." Quote, "It's humbling to remember that we are surrounded by a multitude of fascinating creatures every day, most of which are too small for us to give a second look at as we charge through our busy lives," Heidi says. Oh, yes, he's the actual photographer. And now, here's the cover story. A game. And we'll see if we can read this here. "Is having a sense of self really a hallmark of a sophisticated brain or simply an accident of evolution? Sophia Delenive investigates. The title is The Why of Me. Look into the mirror and you may see pimples, wrinkles, unruly facial hair, but beneath the superficial lies something far more interesting. Every time you lock eyes with your own reflection, you know exactly who's looking back at you. The sense of self is unmistakable. It's so much a part of being human that we often fail to notice it. Yet self-awareness is one of the biggest mysteries of the mind. How did it arise and what is it for?" You can see that I'm really getting tired here, so this is why this expression is getting back in. "Looking at other animals suggests we are not alone in being able to recognize ourselves in a mirror. Admittedly, it's a short list of species that seems capable of this feat, but hints at a possible explanation, self-awareness may have evolved on only the brightest animals and the biggest brain. If so, it represents a peak of mental complexity, the highest form of consciousness." Okay. "However, some people have started to question this idea. Thank goodness we have an article on it. Now, an extraordinary finding lends weight to this skepticism. One monkey species was previously deemed unable to recognize itself in America and easily learned to do so. This isn't simply another name to add to the echelons of self-aware. Discovery suggests we need to fundamentally rethink our ideas about mirrors and minds. The hunt for self-awareness among non-humans has been going on for decades, obviously. We're hunting, we're searching amongst the non-humans, but the non-humans are not doing the hunting. In the most widely used test, the so-called face mark test, researchers stealthily apply a spot of odorless dye to animal's forehead or cheek, and then observe the reaction when it's in front of the mirror. The underlying premise is that those with a firm sense of self can acknowledge their reflection and attempt to scrub at the dye. Most of the animals that have passed this test are considered to be intelligent. They include chimps, bonobos, orangutans, Asian elephants, and Eurasian magpies, obviously not apes. Remember the notoriously clever COVID, which is crow family. Killer whales, bottlenose dolphins also seem to recognize themselves in the mirror, although their anatomy means they can't remove a face mark. The apparent correlation with smarts means self-awareness has become a sort of proxy for mental complexity. But, as the more puzzling evolutionary, there are more puzzling evolutionary gaps. Gorillas, for instance, usually fail the test, with the notable exception of a recently deceased koto. Oh, obviously he didn't kill himself trying to frighten himself. Yet there is a more distant primate relatives, orangutans, pass it. So the self-aware elite contains some bizarre anomalies such as pigeons, mantle rays, ants, and even a robot. Some of these findings, particularly with ants and pigeons, are contested. That's outrageous. How dare you contest a scientific story? I know that cats hate looking at themselves. Researchers have tried to explain away others, arguing, for example, that gorillas have mentally regressed since the split from their ape lineages because they face fewer pressures in their environment. But the recent discovery in monkeys is harder to dismiss. This is opposite. The monkeys now can with their train. Last year, Li Tang Cheng and his colleagues at the Shanghai Institute of Biological Sciences, China, released video footage of a small group of rhesus monkeys interacting with a mirror. It shows monkeys contorting their bodies, tucking their face, inspecting their fingertips, and making flashy displays of their genitals, as you would, all the while keeping their eyes on their reflections. They are captivated, leaving little doubt they recognize themselves, yet the rhesus monkeys have consistently failed the mirror test. Stupid monkeys. Just a few weeks early, the one studying in Chang's team was showing no signs that they could understand the reflections. What changed? In fact, there is anecdotal evidence that monkeys in the lab show a sudden interest in mirrors after being fitted with bulky neural recording devices that protrude from their heads. Chang's team wondered whether the monkeys generally lack self-awareness or whether they're being held back by lack of coordination and inability to link what they saw with internal signals generated by muscle movements. Just as they taught the monkeys to link vision and movement by giving them a food reward for touching a projected laser dot. At first, the researchers shone the laser where the monkeys could see it easily. Gradually, they worked up to shining it in places visible only in the mirror. Fast forward a few weeks of practice and they passed the face mark test with flying colors. So that's actually interesting. At least this indicates that we test for self-awareness is flawed. Mirror, mirror, says on the right. That in turn raises the possibility of self-awareness is much more widespread than we think. Which is, do you pass the mirror test? So what do we know about the evolution of the prized trait? Levels of consciousness. Many psychologists and anthropologists, great bunch, hold that there is a hierarchy of consciousness that corresponds with increasing brain complexity. This is based on minimal consciousness attributed to animals with simple nervous systems. I should say this is this bird comes up to me. These minds are thought to permanently adrift in a sea of raw sensory experience, tossed around between perceptions such as colour, hunger, warmth, fear, with a little awareness of their meaning. Few minds are sophisticated enough to experience the world differently through the introspective lens. Even then, they may have a limited sense of self. Only at the peak of mental complexity do we find a mind able to construct a lifelong narrative of experience centered around the abstract concept of self. These are the elite. Can you imagine non-self-aware animals just finding us so boring? What is the evidence for the hierarchy? After all, mental complexity is a slippery concept, and besides, none of us has insights to even the mind of another human, let alone that of a beetle. Well, there's no question that some brains are much bigger and more structurally complicated than others. Okay? Disparity mainly is a result of differing evolutionary demands in animals and species to survive. For example, the nervous system of a sedentary, filter-feeding oyster consists of, you stupid oyster, just 2 cell clusters. These allow it to do exactly what the oyster needs to do: control its digestion and transmit light from a single sensory tentacles to the muscle that snaps it shut when predators loom. Can I actually say, this is what I think, I shouldn't say, this is what I think people surrounding the education system are doing. I think they've been devolving. Meanwhile, at the other end of the spectrum, there is one peculiar demand that seems to have led to the evolution of complex brains that could have also created the conditions for the sense of self to arise. The challenge is dealing with the minds of others, be they prey, competitors, and other members of the social group. According to the social brain hypothesis developed by Robin Dunbar of the University of Oxford, life in a tight-knit community is especially challenging because the close relationships hinge on being able to understand what's going on in other individual brains. I can't understand how dogs would not... I don't understand what they're talking about. To achieve this, brains need to evolve from being simply things that experience sensations and thoughts to become becoming their observer. To do this, they need to build a model of mind, according to neuroscientist Michael Grazino at the Princeton University. And once the biological machinery for such a model building evolved, it could be used to represent not only the minds of others, but also one's own mind. Okay, I'll accept that one. A model to be for mind reading, whether forecasting or whatever, usually starts with the assumptions about the factors that contribute to the system in the question of their relative importance. It then runs the simulation depending on how much the result diverges from the physical observation modifies the assumptions. The model thus requires an accurate representation of forces at work, allowing it to make reasonable predictions of the future. The brain is a model builder. I think this is really important about models in science. So what is it? You have concrete, abstract, and mathematical models, and all of them can represent and run a simulation forward. You can't move your arm properly if your motor system doesn't, which is true, know where it is. It can't predict where it will be in the next few seconds if it can't run simulations about what will happen if it sends out the command to the muscles. And, he argues, the brain uses exactly the same strategy to model the minds so that if you can interact socially, if it is correct, then you consciously experience is a simulation. What about the goat's hand thing? Oh, all this type of thing. By extension, self-awareness is the conscious state of running a simulation on your own mind. Grazino believes that we have no reason to put it on a pedestal. Self-awareness is not higher order or intrinsically more complicated than consciousness. He says, it's another example of consciousness. A mind is just an object that the brain can model. I think that's good. And so become aware of. Moreover, it's hard to establish whether this ability is associated with uniquely conscious, complex biological machinery. Oh, God. After all, we are still struggling to pin down what consciousness looks like in the brain. Most researchers agree that the brain operates at least partly by generating simulations. However, I think... What? It's bizarre. I think... Show me the research who doesn't think that. However, Oh, well, it says, however, many disagree that consciousness is a functional piece of modelling machinery. Instead, a widely held view sees it as an unintended byproduct of information rushing through a closed loop of connections in the brain. Consciousness can't help existing despite serving no particular purpose, just like noise emitted by a running engine, which has no bearing on the workings of the engine itself. By this way of thinking, self-awareness isn't a simulation, it's just a hall of mirrors. Okay, I'll take that one. So emergent phenomena are common in nature. They give us a mesmerizing impression of complexity and intentionality, despite stemming from a system whose simple components operate with no regard to the phenomena itself. One notable example is the collective behaviour of a flock of birds, which can be modelled using individual driven by just two opposing forces, the instinct to follow their nearest neighbours and to back off and to get too close. And of course, there's got to be a third force, an environmental thing. So the birds have to say, and I also don't want to crash into the ground, all the birds will just crash into the ground, or I don't want to fly up indefinitely. You know, they've got to make other decisions there. Oh, I just wanted to add that one. Apparent complexity emerges even in petri dish bound chemical colonies where individual bacteria ultimately respond to chemical signals secreted by the neighbours to regulate their proximity. The structure that emerges has no agency or purpose. It is purely an indicator of the forces at work in the individual, except it is sort of programmed evolutionary. Similarly, self-awareness may be apparently complex phenomena that emerges from the brain. However, unlike with the birds and bacteria, the mind cannot observe its individual components. It can only glean the echo of billions of neurons responding to each other with electrical signals. The flow of signals is dynamic, rushing along different sets of connections at every moment. I do like it. I do like that picture. It's sort of like a flock. Your brain is like a flock. But some parts are more well-trodden than others. In humans, the predominant connection seems to be those used to contemplate the minds of others. The same connection used to contemplate ourselves. What emerges from the pattern seems constant. To you, that is your sense of self confined inside your petri dish of your brain. That's beautifully put together. Isn't that a beautiful piece of language? I should say that the thing is, if I say, oh, look, I don't think I have consciousness exactly like someone else, the neuropsychs go, However, so I think the scientists have got a certain amount of shying away from shaky sentences. In other animals, the well-trodden paths of brains will be different. In bats, for example, it might be those transmitting information from the echolocation clues. Used to construct a 3D model of the world, there will be huge diversity of emergent mental patterns that serve various survival needs of different species. Put it this way, there's no clear hierarchy of consciousness corresponding to mental complexity. Consider the octopus. I do. And I think when I've got a complicated problem in life, I go off. I say, what do you think about, mate? Mate, the car's broken down. There's petrol on the road. What do you think about? I'm considering the octopus, mate. Okay. In fact, some of nature's most sophisticated minds probably lack a sense of self as we know it. In mammals, those with bigger social groups generally have bigger brains, implying the sense of self goes hand in hand with intelligence. But some other animals seem to have evolved a high intelligence without having to understand their minds of others. Take the cephalopods. You look like isolated animals, I'd say. Cephalopods, aren't they? Well, they are octopus, aren't they? A group of marine animals that include cuttlefish and octopuses, each having spent years collaborating with marine biologist, philosopher of science, Peter Godfrey Smith at the University of Sydney. Ooh, that's a very dodgy thing to say. Believes the particularly large brain of the common octopus is shaped mainly by unique demands of the soft body animal inhabiting the environment dominated by vertebrates, i.e. you are unpackaged yummy lunch. This challenge may have triggered the evolution of bodily self-awareness akin to that of the primates. But Jeffrey Smith sees a clear distinction between the two. Quote, when one watches an octopus squeezed into a tiny space, it certainly looks different, he says. Either way, we can rest assured that if an octopus has a sense of self, it will have very little in common with the self that inhabits our brains. Okay, there was a piece of meaning there. I think it's been lost. It's sort of flown out of the article. Over the top of my shoulder. In any event, it is even less likely to be something we can measure with a mirror. Indeed. This all makes it clear that the best we can hope for with mirrors is an imperfect glimpse of our minds like our own. What's more, if we proceed under the assumption that such a mind are true pinnacles of complexities, then we'll miss out on the most beautiful thing about minds. And this is it, drum roll, that they are biological machines for adaptation, with the contents that can be sophisticated in so many ways. I don't want to put that article down, but it did actually disappoint me at the end. 49 minutes, I'm just running out of steam here. I'm doing a lot today. I'll just put this through. We've got a few more articles to go to close off this one. I think I might be able to do this in three hours is the necessary time to read a New Scientist cover to cover. Here you go, it's a lot of value, I think. 3 hours of dedicated reading for, how much does it cost? Cost Australia a whopping $9.50. So for a weekly magazine, that's a bucket load of money. That's, you know, you're getting up to half grand a year just to have this in your hand. Thanks a lot for listening. Bye. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.